when I used to fly the F-15, the F-15 had a max G limit of 9 Gs, 9 times the force of gravity. When you get to 9 Gs, it's a solid tone. It's basically beep, and you're like, all right, like I'm max performing the jet. But if you pull just a little bit more, you overshoot it more frequently, you would hear this tone in your helmet go beep-boo, beep-boo, beep-boo. You're like, oh man, I just over-G'd the jet. If you over-G every once in a while, that means that you're taking a risk, right? I would rather have folks coming to me once a quarter saying, hey, I made this mistake. I was trying to max perform and take a risk, and I made this mistake. Like, there's a difference between a mistake and a crime, right? And let's learn from it. Let's spread that knowledge and then go out and do it again. And if you weren't taking risks, you're not going to generate those venture capital equity returns that folks want.
Hello and welcome to the Making Better podcast. My name is Matt Jurtzen, founder of Better Everyday Studios, and I am so excited you are with us today. In the world, there are generally two kinds of people. There are those who take the world as it is, and there are those who choose to make it better. On this show, we talk to those who make the second choice. Whether they are looking to improve themselves, their teams, or their organizations, our goal is to give you actionable insights of how to improve your own performance and the performance of those around you, hopefully with a little bit of inspiration thrown in as well. Our guest today is Matt Kuda. Matt and I have actually known each other for over 20 years. We were freshmen at the U.S. Air Force Academy together. We both became pilots. And though his career is much more distinguished than mine, we are both very passionate about space. Matt is a decorated F-15 pilot, having been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, the U.S. military's highest combat aviation medal. After leaving the Air Force, Matt went into private equity at Goldman Sachs before getting into space as the founding executive director for Space for Humanity. In 2019, he co-founded Voyager Space to focus on building the foundation of a profitable space ecosystem. In this episode, we talk about how to tell if you have enough information to make a decision, the key pillars of merging organizational cultures, and some of the key skills needed for any organization to grow, whether you are a solopreneur or a billion-dollar company. But before we get into the discussion, I want to remind you to like and subscribe this episode. And if you were already subscribed, then please share this episode with at least one other person, because after all, that is how we grow. I can't tell you how much it means to me. So with that, let's get into the discussion with Matt Kuda.
So Matt, I can't believe it. We've known each other for over 20 years now. And I don't think when we first met, or, you know, we have kind of a gap in the middle of that. I don't know if I ever knew you were super interested in space. So how did you wind up in the space world?
Yeah, actually, my when I was real little, I lived in Denver, and you know, this is before the internet, really, and I used to read the newspaper, and it was the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post, and there was this article. I still remember, I was at maybe like fifth grade or something. It was about Motorola and how they were using satellites, I guess, for communication or something. I don't remember exactly, but I remember it was Motorola in space. And we had these like little yellow sticky notes, and I wrote on a sticky note that I gave to my mom that said, when I grow up, I want to fly satellites. And, funny enough, my mom actually still has that sticky note. And I didn't end up flying satellites. I ended up flying the F-15 in the Air Force. But as a fighter pilot, you used a lot of space-based assets and imagery, navigation, communication. So after that, I decided I should go ahead and start a space company.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible story. I think I have a somewhat similar story, but not nearly that dramatic, since you actually went out and started a company. But in terms of this idea of wanting to be in space for a while, I think that happened with a lot of people. So how did you make that transition? Because after the Air Force, you went into investment for a little bit, and then how did Voyager kind of come to be?
Yeah, good question. I after I left the Air Force and flying, I wanted to do something completely different than aviation, government, national security, military, and I wanted to learn about business. So I went and got my MBA at Duke Business School, and through multiple turns of events, I ended up working on the private equity investment team at Goldman Sachs and their global headquarters in New York City. We had an $8 billion fund. I was on the investment team, and we were just, you know, making different types of private investments. And I learned a lot about, you know, to call it the concepts of value creation, how capital flows throughout a system from like either a pension fund or endowments funds to managers, to companies, and back again. And so it was a great place to learn, great team. And once I kind of was there, and I felt like I kind of learned generally some of those foundational concepts, I really wanted to build something. And I started thinking about what was I good at. And I'm like, well, you know, despite wanting to get far away from national security and aerospace and defense, I did it for many years. But now I kind of had this newfound tool in the toolkit of business, I guess you could say, and capital allocation and capital market knowledge. And so I thought, why not try to combine those two things together? And aviation, while I flew the F-15 and, you know, I fly in lots of aircraft now for business, it seemed a little bit older, like it kind of had already been had. And space to me was like the future. I think it's acyclical, it's recession resistant. I think it's a mega trend. From a national security perspective, it's the ultimate high ground. And so I thought about, you know, marrying up an exciting industry with a lot of growth prospects with my prior military background and then my time at Goldman Sachs. I decided to leave the Goldman investment team in New York City and move to Denver and started Voyager.
Definitely one of the centers for space in the U.S. at least. It'll make sense to relocate for something like that. And then you started, you know, you've acquired a lot of companies since you started it. Has there been a specific kind of strategy? I'm sure there's been a strategy to that acquisition. I don't know, what's kind of been your guiding star for what you're trying to achieve?
Yeah. We've acquired seven operating companies in a little over 4 years. And, you know, space is not a traditional private equity or strategic. I don't think it's primed for, call it a those types of acquisitions. And the reason why is, you know, private equity, which I respect, I used to do it at Goldman. A lot of space companies do not generate the free cash flow characteristics that would make it terribly compelling for a PE investment. And then there's a lot of smaller and middle market, lower middle market space companies that have a lot of capability. They have their technologies proven out. They have assets in space that work, but they're ran by a technologist, or they're not terribly knowledgeable on how to scale the business in certain ways. So they'll likely never produce within the current construct of that leadership venture capital returns. So I call it new space purgatory. There's these companies that are in this lower middle market that are generating revenue, profitable, have assets in space, that have a lot of track record and heritage. And there's, you know, not many buyers for them. Additionally, call it a strategic acquirer, like a strategic being Honeywell, Boeing, Lockheed. You know, a lot of these founders that started these smaller companies, they left those companies to start their space company. And for them, selling and going back to work as a director or vice president is not really culturally like something they'd probably be terribly interested in. It's not a win for them.
Yeah.
You know, use the example of imagine Elon Musk working as a vice president at Honeywell. It's kind of funny just to think about. You know, not nearly as wealthy, but equally as creative in their ideas, I'd say. So the other thing with space is it's not a traditional free cash flow aggregation, throw some leverage on it, and then flip it to the next highest, you know, EBITDA buyer up the private equity chain. The way to really create value in space is more supply chain economics, where you're should be moving up the supply chain, becoming more capable, winning business that is more valuable. And the reason the primes control 80% of the economics is because they're the most capable. The problem is, you know, they're large organizations, hundreds of thousands employed, not terribly fast moving. And you have a lot of these smaller companies that are very nimble, very creative, have very exciting technologies, have a lot of ambition, but they're frequently undercapitalized. So when we think through Voyager, it's like, how do you kind of combine the best of both worlds, a company that's ambitious, that also has the capability. So what we were doing was strategically assembling core parts of the supply chain in-house, operationally integrating that within an operating company model. We have two business segments. And with the goal to move up the value chain so that we could be prime capable, that we could win a prime contract. And then at that time, when you're at the top of the value chain, now you're the one who's dictating the pricing and the buy versus sell and, you know, trickle down margin economics. And it so far, you know, that's proven out quite well. We won our first prime contract after being in business for like 2.5 years. It was a significant one, which is to build the private replacement of the International Space Station, as a matter of fact. Yeah. So, you know, the strategy was strategically assembling core parts of the space station supply chain with the anticipation and the hope that we would have enough credibility and capability in-house to be selected as a prime contractor to do a program of that scope.
Yeah, that's awesome. That makes a lot of sense. And just to break it down a little bit for some of the folks listening who maybe don't know what prime is or have never been involved in this kind of stuff, and just to make sure I'm understanding you as well, you know, I think a lot of startups in the space area in particular, it's like they might be great. They wanted to go build a really great on-orbit thruster, like a really great like single engine. Problem is that the end buyer, like they call it NASA, isn't looking to buy a thruster. They're looking to buy a whole spacecraft. And so they need to contract out to a prime that's like, theoretically, who says, we're going to build you a spacecraft. And then they either have assets inside them, their company that do it, or they go subcontract out to other companies that do it. And so it makes sense, this whole idea kind of moving up the food chain or moving up the supply chain is how you, because every layer of subcontracting I'm guessing pulls out just like a little bit of profit, a little bit of profit. And so it makes it harder and harder for, as you said, control your pricing for you to have enough profit margin to really be of value as an organization because the layers above you are taking it. Is that kind of
certainly
understand it?
Yeah, no, you explained it well.
So then one thing that you hit on there that I found really interesting at the beginning, and this doesn't need to be like specific to, you know, your acquisition. When you talk about a lot of these startups, because you're right, I've seen so many of these really cool companies that are doing like, you know, they're doing little hopper spacecraft and stuff like that at a small scale. And they exist like for years or even decades without really accomplishing, like really being able to grow and build beyond kind of the capital or just like this, you know, moving up the chain. Are there any specific skills? Are there other specific skills that you've seen that a lot of organizations need to develop in order for them to grow? Because like you said, I think a lot of times it's a technical founder who's really in this one thing. What are the common missing components between them and, say, a SpaceX or a Rocket Lab or a company that is able to grow a lot?
Yeah. I think, I mean, there's a couple things, right? So these smaller companies that have this technology. To your point, SpaceX was not created as a company to build a single rocket motor. It's a company to replace the space shuttle, right? And to take it to another level, it's a company, it's a transportation company transporting humans and cargo to space. In order to build a transport aircraft to transport humans and cargo to space, you need a lot of different technologies, right? So I think a little bit it rests on what is the ambition of that founder, you know, for them building the world's greatest thruster might be that, which is perfectly fine. You know, thrusters are very important. Likely the ability though to take a company that's doing just a thruster, just as a hypothetical example, their ability to scale and grow their market cap is limited. It's capped out to a certain point, right? So part of it's like, what's the ambition? Is the company looking to build a thing, a specific thing, or are they looking to really, you know, create almost a new market or be a platform of many things that then unlock something that didn't previously exist?
Yeah.
Another thing that I see is, you know, a lot of these times these companies don't understand how to access capital. And as companies ebb and flow with their ideas and they pivot whatever they were going to do, maybe they're going to build thrusters, then they build this, then they build that. You know, if they understand how to access capital, it will help them get market feedback. And it'll help, it's very valuable for them to know, like, well, there's no market for this type of, you know, thing, but there's a market for that type of thing. And I see it sometimes the technologist founder gets emotionally attached to the technology as opposed to thinking, is there an actual market for this besides building maybe a one-off for a demo mission, which, you know, which is great, right? I mean, a customer needs that, but investors are going to ask, well, what happens after this one demo mission, right? Is there a tail of operations kind of a thing? And then probably the last thing I would say that we see frequently is, and this is a little bit detailed, but companies that raise capital end up getting a convoluted cap structure where they have differing prioritizations among share classes. A, you know, is contradicting to the B, which doesn't work with the guys who came in before the A, and then there's a convertible note, and the founders have a preferred share, but then the C has this. And next thing you know, you end up tying up the company's ability to access future capital into this Gordian knot. So I think it's very important for founders who aren't knowledgeable on topics like that to get a lot of advice and mentorship from folks that are knowledgeable or have done it, and have to be prepared to walk away from investment money because otherwise it might be helpful today, but in 3 years, it turns out could have been a disastrous thing, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting just sitting from my own perspective of trying to build my own business on a very different, you know, several orders of magnitude different scale. But how many of those same kinds of things apply in terms of, you know, like in my world, which is in learning and development, and a lot of people listening are instructional designers. And in that world, just thinking through what do end buyers, are you creating a whole solution for people? Or are you offering like just like tools to any solution? And those have different values in the market. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, kind of to your last point about the cap table, obviously, there's no cap table for a company like mine or for an individual person, but you do still tie yourself up into different financial arrangements that make it easier or harder for your company to pivot. Maybe you have your own company, but you're also subcontracting with somebody, and subcontracting with them, you have an agreement that says you're not going to go after certain people or, you know, after certain kinds of companies. And so kind of to any level of scale, in terms of a business, it still makes sense of just that same idea as you said of where are you at kind of in the value chain, what the solution that you're offering to people, and how are you keeping your operations under control in such a way that you can pivot and change in ways that make sense for the organization to move forward, and you're not tying yourself down. So it's interesting, I think, how some of those same kind of lessons or rules apply to every level, from the individual who's trying to be their own solopreneur, all the way up to these massive companies.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one thing we always try to do is maintain optionality. It sounds a little bit oxymoronic, but be decisive while also delaying making a decision as long as possible. That gives you some optionality, but you also don't want to take forever to make decisions. So it's always a fine line, right? Have I gathered enough data to make an informed decision and maintain optionality, or am I being indecisive, right?
Yeah. To go a little bit deeper on that, how do you think about that? Because I was listening to a podcast just earlier today that talked about so many of the decisions. There's not like a A or B or right or wrong. It's a spectrum, right? Of when you decide you have enough information. Are there any checks that you have in your mind to try to figure out exactly what you said? Am I being decisive, or am I waiting too long?
I don't have like a checklist, I guess you could say, but you know, for decisions that are important, you know, I frequently do a few things. One, I like to talk to people one-on-one. It might take a little bit longer. Let's say there's five executives that are involved in a very large, important opportunity or decision. And instead of me talking to them all at once, I typically like to talk to them individually. It's not like an interrogation. It's like, hey, like let's catch up for 20 minutes. And I'll just kind of have a casual conversation to understand how they're thinking. Because what I find is frequently, there's always one person who seems to be a bit more outspoken and a bit quieter. But when I talk to them individually, it's less about them. They're not talking about each other. They're giving me their honest view of this project, let's say. I'll just try to fuse that data based off kind of calibrate, you know, I know there's some people on my team who are very pessimistic, right? And some people on my team are very optimistic, and some people view it through the lens of, you know, I'm a finance guy or a contracts guy. And, I like to get all their different viewpoints if I can before I make a decision. If I don't do it individually and it's more of a group meeting, I typically don't talk much, if at all, and I kind of let them talk. And so I can hear everything, because I note that if I end up talking, then, you know, folks stop talking. You know, Charlie Munger, who was Warren Buffett's, you know, partner at Berkshire Hathaway, he talked a lot about mental models, and which I'm a fan of. And the one mental model, which is, I think, is probably the easiest, but I find it useful all the time, whether it's in making a decision or negotiations with a counterparty, is thinking about things from the opposite direction, whether it's like the opposite counterparty, or like, okay, if we make this offer or proposal to a customer, and think through like a couple different ways that they would respond, like kind of counter negotiate to me. And then I typically will think, okay, then how would I then respond to them in an opposite fashion? And I find that to be very valuable. And then the last thing that I do, things seem frequently to be very urgent, but most things actually are not urgent. So I do the Eisenhower matrix. I'm old school. Yep. I write stuff down, and it's, you know, delegate, delete, reschedule. And I'm the fourth one, I'm blanking, but or do. And it's basically a grid of urgent, not urgent, important, not important. And it really helps me prioritize my time and the things that are important, that are decisions I have to make. Even if I feel like I'm pretty confident on it, typically I'll still sleep on it. And I find myself able to think more clearly. And sometimes in the morning, I've either calmed down or I've had an interesting idea. So I on important decisions, I almost always, you know, sleep on it.
That's actually one thing that Daniel Kahneman talks a lot about is delaying decisions. And the more you can create some kind of distance between your data gathering phase and the actual decision-making phase, it really, in his book, Noise, it really talked about how that really helps improve the quality of decisions, the more you can kind of separate that out. So it makes sense.
I can see that. You know, I think it was Aristotle said, was it Nicomachean Ethics, maybe? I don't remember exactly what book it was, but that the only good decisions get made when you're on a walk. And so I do, everyone knows at Voyager, I do a lot of walking. It's like walking and thinking, and in that movement, that like methodical, just like, you know, step outside in the nature, typically, it allows me to kind of think through all those different data points and in kind of a more thoughtful way. So
that's funny. Travis Kalanick, the Uber founder, was famous for that as well. He had a hole in there in the Uber office. There was actually a whole track that he would walk around, and he always talks about how sometimes he'd walk multiple marathons a day, just thinking, and most of his meetings he would hold walking meetings.
Yeah, I do that quite a bit. I didn't know that. It's interesting.
So stepping away a little bit from you, like your decision-making process. So since Voyager has been formed through, you know, bringing together all these different companies, and, you know, I'm sure it takes time to merge those companies. I don't know, what are some of the things that you all think about, that you think about when it comes to, as you said, these companies all have different founders, different reasons for starting their companies, different goals. What are some of the ways that you think about bringing them together to create kind of a cohesive culture that is Voyager space and isn't just a conglomeration of all these different companies?
Yeah, it's hard. It's a hard challenge, particularly if you acquire a company that's been around for a while, right? Because they've developed their own culture and leadership and processes, procedures. There's a couple things though culture, people, economics, are probably kind of three. Culturally, how do you align their culture with Voyager? I mean, one thing I always tell the team at Voyager is just because we're the acquirer, it doesn't mean that we have a monopoly on all the good ideas. So like let's hear what these folks have to say. I mean, we acquire them for a reason because we clearly thought it was a great company, right? But at the same point, fast forward, you know, we want to make sure that we bring them into the Voyager culture. So you have to set an example of what that means. We have these things that we recently published called the 10 Voyager Principles. But it's not easy and it takes time. You know, we've learned some lessons of the faster you go on cultural transformation, typically, at least for us, it seems to work less good than versus taking time. People, you know, the old adage, you know, most employees don't work for a company, they work for their boss, or they work for the one person. So trying to have the leadership team, you know, on down, be leaders of character and have integrity and set the example of you know, working hard and being, you know, what do you want to show? Do you want to be a bureaucratic organization? So do you want to facilitate, you know, leadership for people that always organize a whole bunch of meetings? Do you want to facilitate an entrepreneurial organization? I always tell the story to the team of when I used to fly the F-15, the F-15 had a max G limit of 9 Gs, 9 times the force of gravity. And when you're flying the jet, you have your helmet on. And when, I don't remember the exact thresholds now, but I think it was when you're about 90% of the maximum G limit in your helmet, in the little headphone, you would hear a little beep. It'd be like beep, 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 because when you're flying, you're supposed to be looking outside for the bandit, yep. for the bad guy plane, not looking at your little digital G meter. So you're looking outside, you hear the beep, 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 and you know that you can pull the stick a little bit harder because you have about 10% of the G left. And by tightening the, by increasing the G, you decrease your turn radius, which allows you to outmaneuver the other aircraft. When you get to like 95% of the G, or maybe 99% of the G, it's called the double rate beeper. It's like beep, 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 beep. And that basically means you better not pull the stick back much further. And when you get to 9 Gs, it's a solid tone. It's basically beep. And you're like, all right, like I'm max performing the jet. But if you pull just a little bit more, you overshoot it more frequently, you would hear this tone in your helmet go beep-boo, beep-boo, beep-boo. You're like, oh, man, I just over-G'd the jet, right? And you come back and land a bunch of paperwork, and you got to work with maintenance and all these things. But we used to tell the young wingmen that if you're not over-G'ing the jet every once in a while, you're not attempting to max perform the aircraft. So I don't want you to over-G the jet every day. That's incompetence. But, you know, if you over-G every once in a while, that means that you're taking a risk, right? And I tell that story to the team sometimes when you think about, like, people integration of, listen, like, I would rather have folks coming to me once a quarter saying, hey, I made this mistake. I was trying to max perform and take a risk, and I made this mistake. Like, there's a difference between a mistake and a crime, right? And let's learn from it. Let's spread that knowledge and then go out and do it again, right? And if you weren't taking risk, you're not going to generate those venture capital equity returns that folks want, right? And then I think lastly is economics, right? So, you know, from a Voyager perspective, you know, thinking through how can we allow the key folks that are, you know, now part of the Voyager post-acquisition to benefit from some of the, you know, the growth of the company. Think of things like equity incentive plans, stock options, yeah. you know, RSUs, whatever the companies may have.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to look at it. I could definitely go deeper. I love the G story. And it's so applicable to so many things in life, even to the point of like knowing what's your equivalent in various walks of life. You know, what are the warning signs that you're about to over-G your, you know, your commitment level or on your calendar or things like that. But one of the first things you mentioned was did you call them principles, the Voyager-based principles, is that what you called them?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you come up with those? Like, what was the thought then?
Well, interestingly enough, Nike put out some principles to their employees yep. like in the 1970s or 80s or yep. something. And it was like a clean sheet with a Nike logo and 10 principles. There was no signature. There wasn't a preamble or a conclusion paragraph. It was like, here's the 10 principles. And it's not a vision statement. It's not a mission statement. It's more about like, what does it mean to be an employee at Nike? And I really liked it. And so me and my co-founder, Dylan, we put together something very similar of, you know, from my vantage point as the co-founder of the company, if I look at employees and like, what characteristics would I like to see in employees? What standard would I like to uphold myself to? What do I expect and demand of my direct reports? It should be encapsulated in those 10 principles.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Clear expectations. I think that's what's always, yeah. And to your point, I think very often in the whole spectrum of principles or values and mission statements, more often than not, I think they tend to get too high level, too watered down, too impractical. And probably the most important thing you can do is make sure that they are something that people can look at and know, how do I make decisions today? How do I act during my day to day?
Yeah.
That makes a lot of
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. That's what it is. You know, it's not a, you know, it's like, what do you want out of your colleagues? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, what do you, I guess to kind of close out with a couple of bigger picture questions. I mean, I think you already might have mentioned it, but what's the most exciting project that Voyager is working on right now?
I would say probably it's called Star Lab, which is the replacement for the International Space Station. We're a prime contractor for that. We're building that in a joint venture with Airbus. And when the ISS is disassembled and deorbited in 2030, what we're building will be a replacement for the ISS. But the difference being in the ISS, which is owned by governments, operated by governments, the industry is privatizing the station. So on a go-forward basis, Voyager and our investors and our partners will own Star Lab for 30 years. And then the customers, in this case, governments, research organizations, pharmaceutical companies, entertainment, will pay us as a customer to use it. It's a microgravity laboratory. So, you know, space station as a service, I guess you could say.
Yeah. This so exciting. I mean, we live in this crazy world, you know, where that kind of move started with cargo to the space station being commercialized and then crew to the space station. And I mean, now as of 2 weeks ago, we now have cargo to the moon as a commercial activity, which is pretty crazy.
Yep. Yeah, it's an exciting time to be in the space sector, and it's the technologies will ebb and flow, but from an industrial standpoint, it's not going away. So,
yeah, absolutely, awesome. Well, to finish out, you know, this is called the podcast is called the Making Better Podcast. So one thing that I like to kind of end is asking all the guests if you could, you know, snap your fingers and change one thing to make the world better, what do you think it could be?
One thing to make the world better. You know, there's this psychological effect known as the overview effect. Overview effect is a known psychological shift. It's been measured when humans, namely astronauts, look at the Earth from the outside in, where they look down from Earth from the space station and they see the curvature of the Earth and they see the blackness of space. And when they look down, they don't see borders and ethnicity, religion, genders, you know, money. They just see Mother Earth. And, you know, here on Earth, our perspective is typically, humans' perspective typically is limited by whatever their life experiences have been. So if you never left your neighborhood is your universe. And you know, there's stuff out there, but basically that what drives your decision making. And conversely, in the other end spectrum, if you've traveled all over the world and experienced different cultures, your perspective is different than someone who's never left their neighborhood or their city. We'll extrapolate that to space. And for us, this all seems very normal, right? Like our home, the trees, the roads, the rivers, that's all very normal. But in fact, it's incredibly abnormal. If you're in space and, you know, you look at the Earth, it's like an oasis. You look up and you look away from Earth and you look into space and you realize space is what's normal. That's the 99.999 continuous percent, the black, vacuumless, hot, cold void of nothingness, and that is space. Yeah. And you look at Earth and it's like this oasis, and you have this overview effect where this is like the only Earth that's out there that we have. So to me, if I could wave a magic wand with that backdrop, it would be for everyone in the world to experience the overview effect, to realize that this is the only Earth we have. There's that old Carl Sagan quote, pale blue dot, you know, every human that's ever lived and died has happened on this pale blue dot, and every warlord and religious figure and father and husband and wife and son and child has all lived on this Earth. And it's not going to change anytime soon. So Yeah. The sooner everyone would appreciate that, I think that would be the best for everybody.
Such a great sentiment for anybody who wants to see what I think is one of the better like visualizations of the overview effect or the effect that it can have. Check out a video of William Shatner after he lands from his ride up in Blue Origin, and you have this, you know, world famous actor who's, you know, who's just brought to tears and unable to form words because of what he saw. So it is definitely a very powerful thing. Well, Matt, I want to thank you so much for your stuff, for your time. It's been really great chatting with you. I always love when I can talk shop about space stuff. Glad we got to, you know, relate it to a number of other things as well. I'm sure listeners will get a lot out of kind of hearing that perspective from the top level of what are the things that are important for bringing organizations together, making informed decisions. So thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you liked the discussion, make sure to hit like and subscribe so you never miss an episode. As a reminder, if your team is struggling keeping up with the training development demands of your organization, we want to help. Better Everyday Studios is a full-service instructional design team that can help you with everything from ideation to actual content creation and delivery. Please reach out to us using the link in the episode notes below. Have a great day.